Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be discussing our recent back issue purchases as well as reviewing a classic comic storyline.
Okay, in this back issue spotlight, we're going to be celebrating the fact that we're hitting episode 200 of the Weekly Comic Spotlight. So Bob and I thought it would be fun to go grab a couple of comics that were at issue 200 at some point in time and go cover those. We got issue number 200 from DC, one from Marvel, one from some other publisher. So we're kind of, you know, mimicking our Weekly Comic Spotlight feature. And Bob, I think it's kind of funny. We had to go back really about 30 plus years in the Marvel case. To hit a couple of, you know, issue 200s that we felt were worthy of talking about. It just seems like these days so few titles get up to that kind of an issue number.
That is true.
I think when it comes to doing like a 300s, that's going to get really hard.
Well, I think you got Spider-Man, Batman or Superman, and Cerebus. And then when you get to 400, I think... we're still alive. Well, I hope so. It's only 4 years from now. But, you know, it's going to be really difficult.
I hope the comic industry's still alive.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be... Well, all you'll be doing is back issue spotlights.
Could be.
But, 400 in an indie book is going to be... back to Scrooge again, I guess.
Well, yeah, because I'm glad you picked that one for this, because it was kind of hard to find a 200. I mean, for 300, Cerebus might make sense, just because...
Yeah.
It's probably the best-known indie comic 300 out there. Anyways, so starting us off in DC is really what I think is kind of one of my favorite times and places in the DC universe, and it's Justice League of America number 200. And this came out around March 1982. This is the era of the Justice League I grew up on. You got the JLA satellite. You got the heavy hitters, Aquaman, Batman, Flash, Green Lantern, Martian Manhunter, Superman, Wonder Woman, the Big Seven. You've got the other satellite leaguers. You've got the Atom, Black Canary, Elongated Man, Firestorm, Green Arrow, Hawkman, Red Tornado, Zatanna. Best of all, you've got George Perez on the art at this point in time on the Justice League. I mean, you can't get better than that. This, to me, was a wonderful time to be reading the Justice League. I remember this issue as being a ton of fun when I first read it. When I reread it night before last, I loved it just as much.
It really holds up to the test of time. And also, this is a huge issue. You know, it's got how many pages in
72.
It? 72 pages. And they have all these different chapters that each one has a great artist combination from the era that... in general, is associated with the heroes that are featured, or at least some of the heroes that are featured in that section. And they did such a great job. You know, you have the wrapping sequence by Perez and just lots of other classic great artists.
I think that was a great use of the time-honored technique of, okay, we've got a huge cast of characters. Let's split them up into two or three character groups, do a little chapter on them. And like you said, they've got classic artists that are associated with either one or both are just damn good artists to begin with, you know, for each of those chapters. I thought that was a really brilliant use of the guest artists and that storytelling technique. You know, I thought that was great. You know, I would say that this really kind of set the bar for what an X-100 kind of anniversary issue ought to be. We start out with a recap of the origin of the Justice League. We get a great double-page splash of the satellite, and then we get into the story. And it's not one that's necessarily... I mean, it definitely, in this case, harkens back to their first case, so it's got a sense of history. But it's also got an epic scope, and, I mean, this was just... it was great.
And the thing about this issue is, people who don't have it, if you like the big DC heroes at all, it's a great, great issue... but it is not a particularly expensive issue. I mean, I looked up on some of the back issue websites that I frequent, and you can get this issue for anywhere between $1 and about $3 or $4, which is less than you would pay for a 72-page new comic. And this has got just some fabulous – it's such a fabulous lineup of characters and creators. It's kind of a standalone story. It is definitely worth a couple of bucks to hunt this issue down and buy it for yourself if you have not gotten this comic book in your collection.
I completely agree. I mean, to me, this is really a condensed version of what the Justice League, or not the Justice League, not, well, Justice League and the DC Universe in itself was kind of like back in, you know, early 1982. You get a sense of the feel of the characters, the universe, where things are at, and it's a good done-in-one. Granted, it's 72 pages, so it's not a quick read, but it's a great done-in-one story.
Well, you get some value for your money, too.
I mean, tons.
You know, you pay $4 for this, and I guarantee you it will take you, you know, 5 to 6 times longer to read this than it will take you to read your average $4 Marvel comic book that's coming out today.
If they had done this story today, it would be a 6-issue, you know, arc, and it would need the 6 issues. Now, they did it in, you know, again, the 72 pages here, which is about, you know, 3 current length issues, a little under. But it's such a tight story. We've got a lot of places where, you know, we've got some exposition and stuff. You know, when some of these characters get introduced, there's a bunch of the expository captions. It's like, oh, this is, you know, Black Canary. This is, you know, Red Tornado. And it gives you some of their names, obviously, their powers, some cases some personality, some recent history about them. And just like on that one page alone where Firestorm is bringing the Satellite Leaguers up to speed on, you know, what just happened, there's so much packed into that right there would have taken, you know, in today's decompressed style,
half an issue at least, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, now, one thing I want to start this discussion out with is we're a couple of years apart in age. And when I was reading comics at this point, I'd been into comics for a couple of years, and I think you're just enough older than me that there's almost a quasi, I don't say generational gap, but comic book generational gap, if you will, on one or two of these characters. Specifically, I'm thinking the Martian Manhunter and, to a lesser degree, Snapper Carr. Because when I first read this, it's like, you know, I knew about the Martian Manhunter. He'd shown up in an issue of, I think, DC Comics Presents. He'd guest starred, like, around, I think, 177 and 178 of Justice League. So it's not like he was just never around, but he wasn't kind of the mainstay of the JLA or the DC Universe that he has since become. But I think there was a period of time earlier, certainly in the early Justice League, where he was definitely, you know, a mainstay and then kind of faded to the background for a couple of years. So I guess my question is, back in the day when you had first, because I assume you had read this off the rack, right?
Yes, this one I had read off the rack, but actually I hadn't been reading DC for that much before this came along.
Okay, so you may be same boat as me then.
I started in Marvel, and I only came over to DC like maybe around 78 or so. So I had been reading these books for a few years prior to it. And then I had picked up some of the stuff as back issues, of course, by that point. But I hadn't been reading DC comics for a really long time.
Okay. I think for newer readers, though, at the time, they were kind of in the same boat Firestorm was in, of kind of who is this guy as he's coming and coming into the satellite. And I think there would have been a generation of, you know, older readers or longer time readers that they would have remembered him from the early days of the Justice League. And yep. I find it very interesting how just the span of a 4 or 5 year difference in when you started reading some of these titles can make that kind of a difference.
Yeah. Now, the Justice League is, you know, even though I wasn't a regular DC reader, I had gravitated towards issues here and there of the Justice League when I was younger, just because they had so many heroes on them and they seemed so compelling. I mean, I had picked up that like around issue 88 or so of Justice League. I remember buying that one off the rack. That was a reprint of Justice League 10 and 11 with the fantastic Fingers of Felix Faust. It was a giant issue, and it reprinted two issues. So I actually knew who, so to that end, I did know who Martian Manhunter was because of that. And then I had also read a couple of the JLA, JSA crossovers, in particular, you know, around issue 100, there was a really good one that also involved the Seven Soldiers of Victory.
Right.
I think we talked about on an episode a while back also. So, you know, I knew a decent amount of background on the Justice League, even though I hadn't been reading it forever. But, you know, these are iconic characters.
But with the Manhunter, it was more you knew of him than you really knew him,
right,
having read him. Yeah.
Right. That I hadn't read a long time, you know, of Manhunter type of stuff.
No. What's kind of cool is we get this first chapter here when Firestorm's going up against, at this point, the Manhunter from Mars. Again, they've kind of retooled his name a little over the years. Not a big deal. Art by Pat Broderick and Terry Austin. Now, this is the same crew who, I mean, Broderick had been doing a lot of Firestorm at this point, right? I know he did
yes.
it a little after.
Yeah. Yeah, he was known, I think, for Firestorm, which is why they chose him for this chapter.
I mean, I love how they do that kind of a matching of stuff. Now, one of the things, actually going back to the two-page splash right before it by Perez, I feel obligated to point out, anyone who knows of George Perez knows he is just crazy detailed in his art sometimes. Now, we've got Firestorm up in the satellite, kind of kicking back, wishing he wasn't on monitor duty. Now, I don't know if you noticed it, Bob, but if you look at the satellite in that big panel, if you look at about the, we'll say, 4 o'clock position under the dome...
Oh, yeah, you see Firestorm there.
You see Firestorm there. I mean, again, crazy detail. I love that kind of a stuff. And, again, I was pleased how they were able to segue into each chapter with the different art styles, and it was great.
There's some really nice usage of the full-page splashes in this issue. I particularly like in each chapter they have at least one big full-page splash with the two characters who are squaring off against each other.
Yeah.
In that. And, you know, it's really a cool thing. You know, there's actually a couple of them in the Firestorm chapter.
Well, and I also like how during the course of the chapter and the whole story, we get a lot of information in some of these thought balloons, dialogue balloons, and captions. Now, you could argue it's a very wordy comic in that respect, and it indeed is, but in a good way. But we get, you know, quickly that Firestorm has the atomic reconstructing power, you know, Martian Manhunter can turn invisible, you know, he's got the problem with the heat, and all of this kind of stuff. And it's just, if you were to start at ground zero knowing almost nothing about some of these characters, and yeah, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, iconic, Firestorm, Martian Manhunter, less so. But in the span of just a couple of pages, you get so much information about who they are, what they can do, and their personality that it's just, I was really, you know, pleased how story rich this comic was.
Yeah. So, chapter two, I love chapter two. Jim Aparo, I really think he's one of the best artists, you know, historically that DC has had. I loved his work on Batman. He did a lot of Batman work. He also did the adventure comic stuff with Aquaman, and he did the adventure comic stuff with the Spectre, you know, back in the 80s. And he's just a great artist. He doesn't get as much credit, I think, sometimes as some of the other big artists. But, you know, it was really nice seeing his style there on the Aquaman Red Tornado chapter. And again,
yeah,
he's known for doing Aquaman, so they put him on that chapter. Really nice touch.
Now, one thing about this, and then I want to go back to the end of chapter one for a sec, but in this we've got Aquaman, but I found one of the captions on the second page of this chapter really interesting. And it was, "For him, the tormenting reversals of the last decade had never occurred," referring to how Aquaman mentally is kind of back in time. And it's like, okay, they're trying to give us some insight as to why the original Justice Leaguers are doing what they're doing. But what I found interesting was not so much that, okay, he's, you know, forgotten some of the recent events, but the way they phrase it as a decade of his life has kind of not happened for him. Because, I mean, the time scale on the DC or really any comic universe is one of those sliding scales as to how long ago did the Justice League form and all that kind of stuff. And if you were to say now how long the Justice League had been formed when this happened, wouldn't have been 10 years, I tell you that. You know? But it's, I don't know, I just found that really kind of telling in terms of how much history they had at that point and how much more in the intervening couple of decades. But also, I think time is progressing slower in comics, again, comparing how dense this story is to how it is, like, in current comics of the DC Universe. You know, it, this right here feels, like we said, about 6 months' worth of regular issues today. The other thing I wanted to touch on real quick at the end of Chapter 1 is we've got Snapper Carr having made a comeback. He was another character who hadn't really been seen much in the prior couple of years. I think he'd been in JLA 180 or something about 2 years prior. Other than that, other than I think the Supergirl feature in Superman Family from a good couple of years before that, he'd been out of the limelight since he'd betrayed the Justice League, the location of their cave, to the Joker.
And of course, back in the 80s or so of issue number 80 or so of Justice League of America.
77,
or 70
yeah.
Something, yeah. Yeah, so they didn't really mention that. It's like, traitor.
Well, they touch on it, but it's one of those that, you know, they're not trying to give the entire history of the Justice League here, which is right. Which is good. But, you know, these days, I mean, there are points in the history where Snapper Carr was a mainstay, both earlier than this and even later than this, because a couple of years after this, I mean, after this, he wasn't seen for a while up until I think it was Invasion in the mid to late 80s. I think that was around 88. And then suddenly, you know, he started to make a big comeback for a while and then kind of got pushed back into the shadows and the limbo
again. What was that team book that he was in?
He was in Blasters for a little bit.
Blasters, yeah.
Because that came out of Invasion. And then he also was in Our Man for a while.
That's right. I was thinking of Blasters, where he had he was actually on that team or something. He had some kind of power or something.
He could teleport when he snapped.
Yeah.
And I don't think, you know, Blasters is ever going to make much of a comeback because, man, that was a weak one-shot. But, again, I love some of the stuff going on here with Red Tornado and Aquaman. I found it a little odd that Phantom Stranger actually took some decisive action for once. He's usually one for sitting around just kind of... you know, bemoaning that bad things are about to happen.
I was kind of interesting that he only did something in that chapter as opposed to, you know, jumping in, you know, what I was kind of like thinking back and saying, well, what was it about the Aquaman Red Tornado matchup that made him feel compelled to take action versus, you know, some of these other ones?
I would actually say that one of the things that was different here is these two were kind of evenly matched. I mean, Red Tornado, Aquaman, both are not, you know, lightweights. They're not uber heavyweights like a Superman class either. But to me, that seems like a fair fight. There are a couple other pairings we get a little later where it's like, you know, one of these guys is in big trouble. I'm sorry.
Superman versus Hawkman. It's like, you know, you lose, Hawkman. You know?
Yeah, Flash versus Elongated Man. You know, we'll get to some of these later, and it's like, yeah, this is a little lopsided, guys. But I think Phantom Stranger did one or two other little things later, but yeah, he didn't do a whole lot after that. And then, of course, we get here to Chapter 3, where it's Zatanna versus Wonder Woman. And this was kind of good. It was art by Dick Giordano, who had done quite a bit of the Wonder Woman stuff, I believe, at this point.
Yeah, he was associated with Wonder Woman. And this is also the era of Zatanna, where she mostly could command the elements with her backward spells as opposed to just having them do kind of whatever she wanted.
Well, it's funny because aside from speaking backwards versus in, you know, poems or whatever, her powers were kind of sort of like the Isis character on TV around this time. You know, again, the have the winds lift her up and fly her along type stuff. And she was also in the George Perez costume versus the classic fishnet and top hat outfit.
Right.
Still, great costume design. And again, this is one that I thought was kind of a fair fight. I mean, Zatanna can be a heavy hitter, so can Wonder Woman. It was good. Not surprised how it turned out. And I loved the use of the purple ray. That's one of those arguably silly-ish things of this point in the DC Universe that I miss. I liked that. You know, the Amazons had their technology, they had their healing ray, you know, that kind of stuff. Now they're very mythic and mythological, but I don't know, it loses a little without stuff like that.
Next up, we've got Green Lantern versus the Atom with art by Gil Kane.
Now, he, of course, is known for both of these characters.
Right. It was really nice seeing Gil Kane doing this and that big splash page that he did. You know, it's like classic Gil Kane.
He's one of those artists that has a very definitive style in my eyes. You know, one that can be picked out pretty easily. But man, he just does such great work on these characters. This was another one where I felt the Atom was a little outclassed by Green Lantern. But good stuff, very enjoyable.
And by the way, in between each of these chapters, I mean, there are those pages that slide in that are by George Perez that kind of, you know, tie the little chapters together.
Yeah, they keep the framing sequence going where, okay, you know, Adam's been defeated. He goes up and says, yep, it happened. You're not doing so well. And yeah, like you said, it moves the story along and it gives it a cohesiveness for this whole issue that, frankly, I think a lot of the recent X-100 issues we've gotten haven't had. You know, I think this is a good template for this kind of a story. Now, Chapter 5, Flash versus Elongated Man, art by Carmen Infantino. I mean, who else could you have do a chapter with these two characters?
Yeah, and again, you know, he's strongly associated with both these characters. And just, you know, seeing Carmine do the Flash stuff, you know, is just... And I love, like, he would always do great, crazy stuff with Elongated Man. Mm-hmm. This big full page, the splash page one where he's, like, all kind of spiraled down and, you know, just all kinds of loop-de-loos in his arms and wavy bits and...
The only iconic Infantino thing I don't think we've got here is kind of the hands coming out of the captions.
Yeah.
Which seemed like it was a regular thing in either the Flash and or the Elongated Man stuff. So this was another, you know, really... I mean, some of these chapters are only a couple of pages. But, you know, like with this one, it really showed how these two characters had a history... with each other, you know, pairing them made sense, and just we get a feel for who they are, what they can do, in just really a couple of pages. It's very condensed, very tight writing. I just can't, you know, obviously can't say that enough.
Now the next chapter is the one that kind of breaks that mold because we have
We get into chapter six, one more thing. At the end of this one, Flash is racing off, and he gets to the cave. Used to headquarters the Justice League. And this is where we get a better feel for the time difference that these guys are experiencing. But this cave in Happy Harbor, you know, it hadn't been seen in quite some time. This is the one, again, Snapper had betrayed the location of. This cave later housed the Doom Patrol, the JSA, the Legion of Superheroes, Young Justice, Our Man maybe. It seems like half the teams in the DC Universe have hung out in this place. So if you're ever touring the DC Universe, this is a must-stop at. I'm just saying.
Yeah. There's a lot of rubble around, though.
It's Perez. What do you expect?
Yeah.
So as you were saying with Chapter 6.
So we have Green Arrow and Black Canary versus Batman. Now, this one, the art's by Brian Boland. I think this is probably the first time Boland has drawn any of these characters. Maybe it was the case that, I mean... They couldn't get Neil Adams, and you know he's got because he was a hot artist back then. And he was just around this time doing Camelot 3000, you know, and he's got a really nice style. But you know, it's really nice seeing some panel to panel continuity by Boland since he mostly just does covers nowadays.
Mm-hmm. The guy is an amazing artist. He did some the splash page here. I mean, that's cover material right there with Batman about the, you know, or is he surprising Green Arrow, Black Canary. What I loved here is just how much characterization and interplay we get between, you know, Green Arrow and Black Canary. Batman doesn't really say a whole lot, but again, you get a feel for who he is. And if you were coming at this, like I said, cold and not knowing these characters, so much in so little space, it's just phenomenal how tight this was.
I mean, it's like 5 pages. And, you know, in 5 pages, you get to know all these characters. You get stuff about their powers. You get about, you know, their relationship. It can be done. You know, that's, you know, not only can you do it in a 20-page issue, you can do it in a 5-page chapter.
Yeah.
You just have to want to do it, I guess, is the key.
Well, spend a little time and attention. I mean, this is not something that just, you know, came off somebody's typewriter page. Somebody actually had to sit down and think it through of, I've got so many pages to really spotlight this character. How can I best do it? You know, and then chapter 7.
You know, okay. That's just, you know, Jerry Conway is a classic, kind of old school, really great comics writer.
Yeah.
He's another one that you don't hear him getting a lot of credit all the time, but, you know, he is a great writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, I think there are a lot of creators, both then and now, that are unfairly seen as just kind of that journeyman creator that, yeah, they get stuff done on time, they do good work, but not the, ooh, name, talent. But I look at, again, how much is done in so few pages per chapter, but then you look at the 72-page epic story here, and it's like, this is not just average writing by any stretch of the imagination. Nor average art. Again, some of this is just phenomenal. Next up, we've got Hawkman versus Superman by Kubert. I mean, come on. How can you go wrong with this? Again, kind of a iconic art style, one that's I find very easy to recognize. What I found hilarious here is, like we'd said, I mean, Hawkman's kind of outclassed. He's going up against Superman. I was a little puzzled here and also back in the Atom thing. We got a bit here where it's like, ooh, you know, Hawkman saying he's got to go, you know, 6,000 miles from where he's at in wherever his museum is or whatever. So he's going to do this parabolic arc and do all this kind of sciencey stuff to get there really quick. The Justice League had transporters at this point in time. They've been using them in this issue. Why he needed to fly around like this, I'm a little confused. But he's going up against Superman. He has a plan.
His thinking was kind of muddled because he also thought that he could, for some reason, hit Superman with this flanged mace and actually do something other than break the head off the mace. I don't know what he was thinking. Well, you know, it's like, sprinkle some kryptonite dust on it or something, guy. You know, get a magic spell on it. You know,
he explains he was expecting the Superman robots, which, again, hadn't been used in a couple of years. So I love how they were taking stuff that was back in the storage closet of the DC Universe, essentially, and dusting it off. And he figured having a crossbow, a mace, and a net would confuse the robots because they're used to high-tech weaponry. I don't care what they're used to. It's a net. It's a stick. You're going to club them with something. How hard is that to combat?
The thing is that the Superman robots, even if you thought it was a Superman robot, I mean, these were like, since they posed as Superman, right? They were really strong, you know? It's like hitting them with a stick, as you say, is not going to do a lot, even if it is a Superman robot. It would be a kind of a lame Superman robot if he could hit it with a mace and knock its head off or something. That, you know, doesn't seem...
If this were, you know, some sort of magical kung fu weaponry that's at least surprising and tricky or something. Nope, it's, like you said, a mace. It's, I don't know, brilliant tactician, this one. But again, you know, it was fun.
There's
to
a little
at.
Bit of a slip, but, you know, oh well.
Hey, you go with it. I mean, you're going up against Superman. What else do you do? You do whatever you can think of.
But I like how Jerry Conway, like, you know, so Hawkman gets knocked out and he's like drifting in space, and of course he manages to drift, and they make the point that he's over the southern latitudes because the Zeta beams always hit the southern hemisphere in Adam Strange. He drifts into a Zeta beam and he's on Ran. And then we get to see Adam Strange, who has had an association with the Justice League. So this helps pull Adam Strange into the story for a couple of pages. They do make reference to the first Rand Thanagar War that was in Showcase 101 through 103. And, you know, Adam Strange teleports Hawkman back. They got to retrieve him into the satellite.
Well, what I love here is to show there's no love lost between Rand and Thanagar after this recent war. You know, Adam's like, it's like, hey, we had to send him back in a hurry because, you know, the Hawkman not too popular here. So they send him back in space with no air helmet. So Elongated Man's got to go dive out of an airlock to see if he can get him before he suffocates. It's like, wow, what a good friend. Again, great stuff. Nice kind of, I mean, are those couple of pages mandatory? No, but man, they add so much to the story. It's fun.
Well, actually, what they did was they siphoned the Zeta energy off his body, so he pretty much popped back to where he had been in the first place, although I'm not sure how the satellite popped in near there since it's in geosynchronous orbit, so it shouldn't be moving relative to its position over, I thought, North America.
Yeah, it's over, I thought, Metropolis or whatever, but I mean,
yeah.
I guess they couldn't wait for him to wake up, maybe, or give him... I see some technical difficulties there. It's just kind of funny. But again, it was a good use of Adam Strange. And they got a good nod to some of the history of the Justice League. And of course, at this point, we've had pretty much, I think, all of the one-on-one fights, or two-on-one in the case of Batman and Black Canary and Green Arrow. The old Justice League has gotten their... things they were after, so now we've got to actually get to the meat of the story. And of course, we're well past three quarters of the way through this. And it's basically, as they had hinted early on, the aliens that had come to use Earth as a battleground for some one-on-one combat amongst the seven of them that caused the formation of the Justice League have magically been resurrected through seed clones to go fight it out again. It's like, okay, that works. They split up into two or three groups of these aliens to go fight it out, and of course the Justice League's got to go, you know, regather and go fight again.
That's a great on page 60 and 61 of the story. That kind of half page, double page spread. It's kind of a double page spread along the bottom half of the page. That's got all the 15 heroes.
Yeah, it was great stuff. I love that. That was one that I had put in my notes of, yeah, you got to mention that. I mean, how can you not? Classic, you know, Justice League going into action kind of a shot, as really only Perez can do to a certain degree. Chapter 8, we get about 7 Justice Leaguers, so enough to field a full team here pretty much, going up against 3 of these aliens. And kind of what the point of this chapter is, gee, when they work together, you're going to get your butt kicked. Because in the span of 3 pages, they take these aliens down like nobody's business.
Yep, and then we get a chapter where there's four of them going up against 2 of the aliens, and same thing, 3 pages, they're taken down, and then we have the last 4 Justice Leaguers against the last 2 aliens to make short work of them. What I find interesting is, you know, kind of the aftermath is like they collect up all the pieces of these seed clones and fly them up and throw them into the sun to burn them all up.
I thought it was a bit much that they're literally destroying these aliens. Now, granted, they're seed clones, whatever that really means. Red Tornado mentions, well, they were never truly alive. But I think there were periods, and I arguably would have said this would have been one of them, in the Justice League history where even so they would have erred on the side of caution and considered them alive. You know, but, you know, who am I to say? I did find it interesting in that 10th chapter there, Firestorm's like, New York City, you know, you're wrecking my city. Because that right there, along with the mention of the high school basketball game at the beginning, kind of places that in time for where Ronnie Raymond's at, you know, before going up to, I guess it was Pittsburgh or whatever, for college. Which is where I usually associate him with. And then we get a nice, you know, page epilogue that kind of, you know, I don't want to say fills in, it fits this into the continuity, but I mean, we've had aspects of, you know, Green Arrow's not a member of the team at this point, all that, and it kind of, you know, dovetails all that in. And ends on a nice, solid story beat moment.
And that was Justice League 200. I mean, this was, to me, again, one of the best examples you can find of a centennial anniversary issue. Well worth your trouble to go out and track this down.
Now, I want to quote really quick one paragraph of Jerry Conway's article he's got in the inside front and back cover here. And he's talking about the history of the Justice League and some of his thoughts and whatnot. And he's talking about he'd taken on writing the Justice League with issue 151 on. He's been doing it 50 issues now with this. And first paragraph on the right column there on the inside front cover. Quote, "For my own part, I tried to develop continuity in the stories, to give a feeling that each issue leads naturally and inevitably to the next, that the events in one story may have a ripple effect in the lives of the heroes, reaching a climax, perhaps not this month or next, perhaps not until next year. I enjoy watching the interplay of the characters, pitting one personality against another, and examining the results. For me, the JLA is the ideal superhero team book. It has scope, it's both personal and cosmic." And man, if this issue doesn't, you know, really exemplify that, I don't know what does.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting about this essay is he makes reference to the next book we're going to be talking about, which is Fantastic Four number 200. And he says, how is it that the longest continuously published superhero book that's out there is only just now arriving at its 200th issue? Because this started in 1960 or 61, actually, I think Justice League number one came out. It was in Brave and Bold first. But he points out that it predates the Fantastic Four by almost 2 years. But FF, they hit issue 200 in 1978, whereas this one is hitting it in 1982. And then they go on to point out that the reason for that is that for a large part of its run, Justice League was only published bimonthly or eight times a year. So it just didn't have the monthly schedule that Fantastic Four did. So Fantastic Four kind of sailed past it and hit their issue 200 several years previous.
Yeah. I mean, for me, this was a 72-page story that was a great experience reading originally and, you know, again the other night. We get the origin of the JLA. We get a story that kind of comes out of that. We get solid exposure to, like, 15 Justice Leaguers, enough to kind of get to know them and really, arguably, have a chance to really become fans of some of these characters. Tons of action, tons of story, unbelievable art from a number of really talented artists. If you're curious about what the DC Universe was like back at the start of 1982 or thereabouts, read this issue. I mean, reading this issue again has me wanting to kind of go back to this era of the DC Universe, and I've got tons of unread back issues from around this time frame and kind of find the time to just plow through all of them. This was just great stuff for me. 5 out of 5. Cannot recommend this book highly enough.
I also give this 5 out of 5. Pretty much the, like I said, the best example you'll see of DC in this time era.
Yeah.
And bargain priced. I mean, you can buy this book from a number of online outlets for about what you would pay for a 20 to 22 page comic book, new comic book.
Yeah. Well, and the cover price here was $1.50. So at the time, you know, obviously 72 page is going to be a little expensive compared to the average. But I mean, by today's standards, you're getting so much less story for so much more cost. It's not even funny. So definitely worth hunting down in the back issues.
Okay, next up we've got Fantastic Four number 200. This is a double-sized issue. I think at the time Marvel might have been under 20 pages in size, because this story is only about 36 or 37 pages long.
I was thinking they were around 17 at this point.
Yeah.
Now, this is a few months before I had kind of sampled the title with whichever issue, I think it was 204 or 209, that had Herbie. And long before, a couple of years before, I started getting it every month when Byrne came on. Simply put, wasn't a Marvel fan back then. It took Byrne on this title and Alpha Flight to get me into Marvel. So since I hadn't read this material before, I thought about just reading this issue, but then I realized it was part five of a five-part story. It's like, hey, I want to give this a fair shake. So I started back with Fantastic Four 196, the start of this story arc, and read it from there. Now, also, to be fair, I don't have these actual issues, so I was reading this off the PDF from the Fantastic Four Silver Surfer DVD ROM set that came out a number of years ago. So that kind of colored my reading experience a little bit. I prefer the tangible, what can I say?
Yeah, now, before you point out how aged I am, I did actually buy this off the rack. I started reading Fantastic Four monthly with issue 128. So I had been picking up Fantastic Four each and every month for quite a while by the time this one came along. I had picked up, you know, spotty issues. Previous to that, the first issue of Fantastic Four I ever picked up was 97. But I didn't get it every issue until 128. But I had been reading this title, you know, month in and month out by the time it got to issue 200.
I had read some of the digest-sized Fantastic Four black and white stuff around this time. But like I said, this was the first time I'd read this story. So, now one question I kind of got for you, because you've got more experience in the Fantastic Four by far than I do. This basic era, the Fantastic Four, in this case, the art was by Keith Pollard and Joe Sinnott. Fine artists, but I couldn't help feeling like they were sticking to the house style for this book of Kirby, yet they're not Kirby. You know what I mean? Is that a fair assessment, or am I being a little harsh?
I don't really see a lot of Kirby in it. I mean,
foreshortened kind of perspective, kind of the big, I don't say blocky stuff, but a little bit of that flavor to it.
I don't know. I mean, Kirby's been gone for 100 issues at this point. I think that this is just kind of their style, or maybe it's just the style of FF. I wouldn't equate it to Kirby, because you don't have the
Kirby. Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I'm not trying to say that they're trying to pass off as if it was by Kirby, but it's got enough of that sensibility to it, I guess would be the better way to say it.
I think there's a distinct Marvel style around, you know, this period in time.
That's fair.
Most books kind of followed a general look and feel. And I mean, you can tell now with the training, you could tell when it was one of the Buscema brothers that were doing something, or, you know, there were certain artists. But even with those guys, I mean, their art styles were not radically different. I would say that when Kirby actually did come back, you know, his art visually stood out apart from the Marvel house style. You know, if you look at when he did like that Captain America Mad Bomb run, or, you know, his run on the Black Panther, it looks distinctly different than a lot of these other books. And I think these other books, you know, FF being one of them, Thor at the time, probably Spider-Man, you know, they all had kind of a general similar look and feel.
Yeah. Well, and some of it may just be, in some cases, the panel, the shot in the panel or whatever. If you look at the first panel on the third page, we got the Human Torch, you know, throwing a fireball and stuff like that. And there's something almost iconic about that composition, I guess. And maybe those are the sorts of things that I was kind of feeling. But you know, I think I see what you're saying. I agree with that. I think I was being a little, I don't say harsh, but incorrect on that.
Yeah, and I think that they also had, maybe back at this time, also a little stronger maybe art direction on, you know, giving instructions to people on the kinds of shots maybe that they should have in a what they consider to be a well-told story to make it, you know, dynamic and that kind of stuff, which I think a lot of those probably grew from Kirby.
Yeah.
You know, since he was the iconic, you know, guy who brought to life the Marvel Universe. So, you know, there could be a, you know, a root of a lot of that stuff in Kirby, you know, at least as far as the kinds of shots and the kinds of panel layouts and stuff that they were going for, because Marvel Comics, they wanted to have a certain amount of dynamism to the books.
Well, and it's interesting because they go for that, and there's also, I think, a feel of a house style, like you said, where things are very much on model, which we don't really have as much these days. You switch artists on a book, and suddenly the characters could look very different. Or even in the pages of a particular book, in the case of that one X-Men, where the Beast radically metamorphized between, you know, different subplots.
Yeah, that's true. That was like that Generation Hope one or something.
Something like that. I forget which one, but man. This, though, like we said earlier, this was 1978. Obviously, 200th issue of Fantastic Four, big milestone for them. Fifth part of a major story arc. There were aspects of this version of Doctor Doom that really show just how much the character has grown, evolved, and how much comics have grown and evolved since then. I mean, this was written by Marv Wolfman. I've got tons of respect for him as a writer. He also edited this book. Shooter was, you know, consulting editor, for better or worse. But man, this Doctor Doom, power mad dictator, no two ways about it. Not even the pretense necessarily of protecting his beloved citizens of Latveria, as they have since become. They wanted him the hell out of there.
Yeah, well, you know, they had that whole revolution subplot going, and you know, it's like he's just not taking any nonsense from these people. You know, they're like, you know, one of his minions sasses off and is like, you know, I'll kill you as soon as look at you kind of attitude that he's got. But, you know, it does harken back to, I think, how Reed and Doom have always had this certain kind of dynamic with one another. You know, you kind of get within this story that Reed, in his opinion, you know, and actual fact, you know, if you believe that, you know, he was always trying to help Von Doom when he was pointing out the flaws in his experiments. And Doom was just so wrapped up in himself that, you know, he could not accept any input from a lesser mind, goes along, blows himself up with the machine, you know, back in college. That kind of sets him off on this path, and he's always blamed Reed Richards, and Richards has always, you know, he's like, I was just trying to help you, you know, kind of thing, and it goes back to that.
It's funny that both this and the Justice League 200 are hearkening back to key origins. Now, in the Justice League, it was their origin. Here, it's arguably the more important origin of Doctor Doom, because I think that, you know, colors so much of the Fantastic Four experience. You know, Reed having just gotten his powers back through the cosmic ray stuff, we got a bit of kind of their origin by way of, you know, exposition, more in previous issues than this. But it is funny how these two characters are almost, I don't want to say flip sides of the same coin, because that's not it, but man, they push each other's buttons at times. It is hilarious. And man, you just can't get a good rant and stuff like Doom is given in this issue. You set him off, and man, there's no stopping him.
What I found interesting was, and I didn't recall this from the time, but I guess it was maybe the way that he had, you know, Wolfman had the characters acting. But, you know, Ben and Reed were like kind of going at each other a couple of times in this issue.
Well, at this point, the Fantastic Four technically was disbanded, apparently. That happened a couple issues before, you know, when I had jumped on for reading this of 196. And it was, do we get the band back together or not? So there was some friction from there. And Reed had just been brainwashed into attacking the FF and some stuff like that. And you know, one of the things that I found very interesting and very much was clear in this issue, more so than the Justice League, but I think it was true of DC at the time too, is this was literally in the age of the never-ending battle. Stuff happened and the one issue goes into the next, into the next, into the next. Subplots come and go, plots come and go, but there is a fluidity in a literal continuity between issues back then, which is part of why this is such a hard era for the publishers to collect into trade and hardcovers. Of, it's hard to find a good entry point and a good exit point to the stories, because they just kept going. And that was kind of what Conway was alluding to there in that paragraph I read in his article there. But very much here, because like I said, I read 196, 197, 198, 199, and then here with 200. And there's still story elements that we're touching on in this issue that go back a couple issues prior, at least, like you said, of the FF breaking up and the friction between Reed and Ben. And it's funny how much story they can pack into kind of each issue and over the course of a year. And I think that's part of why comic book time back then was moving a lot faster than it seems to now. They just told more in their stories. I mean, you look at how much ground is covered here. We get the battle in Latveria. We get some stuff back in New York. We get stuff all over the place. I mean, they're not sitting still here.
Yeah, but this issue is only about half as long as the Justice League story in number of pages. But you know, a lot of stuff happens in it, as you said. I mean, and you get some, you know, some big battles. I get some good uses of the powers. I like how Reed escapes from that death trap that Doom's got him in. Although I, you know, the science mind inside me is kind of like, you know, if you got a pressurized container for holding gas, I just don't think Mr. Fantastic would be able to generate the kind of pounds per square inch to burst that container open.
Well, what gets me is, you know, there's also the bit where he's being held down by the wires, razor sharp wires or whatever, and he just kind of between panels is free, and it's like he's just that good. It just shows how he's able, you know, Mr. Fantastic escape after escape after escape, and still Doom throws more at him. It's that Ahab and the hunt for the whale aspect of these two characters that's just kind of fun. It was interesting though. Just I mean, they hinted at here. That whole, you know, just how disfigured is Doom aspect, without giving a clear answer. They never really should give a clear answer either. But this is one that it's interesting, because I thought this was a really good story, and it's just such a different storytelling style in terms of, again, the issue-to-issue continuity than we get these days. It's also one that is, again, a denser read. You look at some of these dialogue balloons, and man, there's a good couple of sentences in them, a good paragraph or two per panel. It's just, there's a lot of stuff, some captions that go into quite a bit of detail. And, you know, again, for this era of storytelling, that was the norm, and it worked well. But if you're looking for the kind of story we get these days from Marvel, where it takes somebody a page to walk down the street and no word is said, you're going to be in for a bit of a shock just in terms of the amount of reading you're going to have to do. For me, it worked. But again, I think for some, there might be some reluctance there.
Yeah. I mean, there is a fundamental storytelling style differential, you know, between the modern comics and the older ones. And I think this is an era where it's distinct from the 60s, where you kind of have to take things a bit with a grain of salt, you know, and, you know, just kind of tongue in cheek on some of the goofy stuff that goes on. Cause they're mightily trying to keep things, you know, more realistic, but there is a very distinctly different style.
Yeah.
Now I will point out, cause I just noticed as I'm looking at this, I mean, the cover is by Jack Kirby. The insides are not, you know, so you can kind of see, you know, they're both inked by Joe Sinnott.
Yeah. Again, there are just a couple of pages here and there that had that kind of a feel to it. There are others that very clearly did not. You go to a couple of pages near the end when Doom and Reed are duking it out, and Reed's sticking his tongue out as he's getting choked or whatever. Not Kirby. You know, just not that kind of a thing. Now, one of the things I did after reading this, because I was curious, The epilogue here, Latveria is a free nation. They're holding elections next month. They're happy they've gotten rid of that maniacal madman. I'm like, okay, where does the next issue pick up? And pretty much it picks up in Latveria with Reed and the gang, you know, standing next to the same Zorba. I don't know if it's the exact same moment in time, but it's the same essential story element in time, if you will. And that, again, goes back to the never-ending battle. This just sets you up for the next issue, it sets you up for the next issue, it sets you up for the next. Once you get sucked into the story, there's not that jumping-off point that we get these days. Now, like I said, I'd read the previous four parts of this story. I do think they did an excellent job in this, giving the story beats, the recaps that were needed from the previous issues, to understand what was going on here. You know, everything from that opening monologue Doom did of, you know, why was I forced to slay my clone? You know, I was cheated out of this. Here's all, you know, and kind of recapping the, not the plot, but his, you know, anguish of what he's just been robbed of in the previous issue. You know, and I like that level of accessibility that they had back then. You know, I think that's one of the things that makes this basic era of comics, frankly, a lot more memorable in many respects than what we get today.
Well, you know, I kind of purposely, I mean, I don't remember these stories from how many
30 some odd
years ago, you know, with absolute clarity. Although, as I was reading this issue, I, before I got to it, remembered the conclusion of it, which is pretty good after 34 years, right?
Yeah.
That I remembered that. But I purposely didn't go back and read the previous issues because I wanted to see, you know, not remembering this thing, you know, can I jump into part five of a five-part story and pick it up as I go along and enjoy the story? And actually I could, you know, which is would be probably a little harder to do with some other part, last, you know, picking up the last part of a multi-part storyline.
Certainly for stuff today, but I think part of it is at this point in time, Shooter was in charge, so I think there was still that edict, or maybe starting of the edict of the, you know, every comic could be somebody's first. So I think they were making a concerted effort to be accessible. And if you hit the ground running in this issue, everything you need is there. You may not have the full expansive context and scope of it all, but you get the essentials. You know, this is why these guys are fighting. This is why they're mad at each other. This is why, you know, Ben's wanting to know what's up with Alicia and stuff. I think there is a lot that today's creators, both writers and artists, could learn from rereading comics from this era in terms of pacing, in terms of accessibility, all that kind of fun stuff.
Yep.
So for me, this was a fun read, good stuff. I gave it a 4 out of 5. I thought it was well worth the time. I'm glad I read the full arc, more just for my own enjoyment than anything else.
Yeah, I gave it a 4 out of 5 also. It was not, I mean, it was a good story, but it wasn't like the greatest story ever.
It didn't have me at the point where I was thinking, wow, I should really be reading those next couple of issues. Whereas the Justice League, not only was I thinking that, I'm thinking, wow, I've got all this Aquaman, this other, you know, Adventure Comics, some Wonder Woman from this era, all this other kind of stuff, like those showcase issues, that I ought to go read. But still, this was fun stuff. Now, rounding out our selection, we did, like we do for the Weekly Comic Spotlight, Marvel or DC and one other, and the other one we picked in this case was Uncle Scrooge 200. Now, this was also, I believe, early 1982. This was done by Whitman Comic, this title, of course, having bounced between a variety of publishers. It says Whitman on the cover, but Western Publishing on the inside, so take your pick on that. I am a recent reader of Uncle Scrooge, only started really with the Boom relaunch of the title a year or two back. So this was the first time I read this material. This was one that I picked up from mycomicshop.com specifically so we could discuss it here and now. Because, as we said, it's not easy finding a non-Marvel or DC comic that made it to issue 200. Much less one that we could both agree, yeah, well, we ought to go do that.
Yeah, it was like one that you'd like to read, I guess, anyway.
In fairness, I mean, there aren't that many indie books that make it this high, so it's not like I'm being overly picky.
I know.
But, yeah, it is one of those that once you've narrowed it down to that kind of an issue number, our different tastes in the indie books do come into play. This had three short stories in it. What I liked is each one featured Uncle Scrooge and one other character, and that allowed the other character act as a foil for Uncle Scrooge and still give him room to shine in these rather short stories. I don't think this issue in and of itself would have made me an Uncle Scrooge fan in and of itself, but overall, as one, I enjoyed this. I thought this was just some good stuff. We start with Marooned in Space, which opens with a... I don't know if this is a common technique in these stories or not, but you know, we see Uncle Scrooge, you know, careening in space on a meteorite or whatever, and it's, well, how did he get there? So they go back in time and tell us. Now, I'm going to nitpick for a second here on this one, Bob. You look at that second panel in the story, we got Uncle Scrooge leaning out his window, complaining about the noise Gyro's making in his house. Now, Gyro's got a sign out on what looks like maybe the second story window at the back of his house with his name on it, in case Uncle Scrooge forgets. Maybe, I don't know. But this also seemed like a bit more of a suburbanish kind of a place than I thought Scrooge would have had. So, I don't know, it struck me as a little humorous.
I'm going to have a different opinion on this issue than you are, so I'm not going to come to Uncle Scrooge's defense on some of these nitpicks that you make.
Oh, I don't think Scrooge is the one who needs the defense here.
Yeah. Overall, the writers and artists. I mean, to me, reading these Uncle Scrooge stories gives me the solid appreciation for why Carl Barks and Don Rosa are acknowledged as the masters and, you know, doing really good Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck and a lot of the Disney material, because the guys that did this story, who are uncredited, you know, they're certainly no Carl Barks or Don Rosa. I mean, you have things like this where, you know, in a Barks or Rosa story, they go a little bit out. They go outlandish, fantastical, but they keep things within reason. And they're also relatively meticulously researched and maintain a certain amount of continuity. You know, and again, you're right. I mean, Scrooge does not live in a, you know, suburban wooden house, and you know, they wouldn't be flying around in space eating ice cream sundaes, and you know, some of this business that goes on in this issue was, you know, it's like, okay.
Well, I mean, clearly space physics are a little different here in the Duck's world, but I don't know if that makes the science classes easier or harder. But you know, I'm willing to go with some of that. And I agree, this is not a Carl Barks, Don Rosa quality Duck story by any stretch of the imagination. To me, this is like you're at a museum that has some of the finest pieces of art in the world. They're going to have those in the showcases, but you're going to have a couple other hallways, a couple other rooms, where you got to put something up on the wall. This is that kind of stuff. It's
right. It's okay. It's okay, and it's certainly, you know, it's fine to give to a kid, and you know, they'll enjoy it. It's just it's certainly a number of levels below what you'd find. I just want to make it clear that, you know, when you hear people raving about Uncle Scrooge as being such a great character, I certainly wouldn't take this comic book and lay it into their hands as an example of, you know, why people revere, you know, the character Uncle Scrooge. You need to give someone a Barks or a Rosa story for that.
Well, the Life and Times, I think, is a good example.
Life and Times is a great example, and there, you know, are a number of they'll be reprinting them coming up in a few months. You know, the Carl Barks stuff is going to get reprinted in some affordable, you know, $20 or $30 editions, I think, from Fantagraphics. You know, that would be the way to introduce people.
This is the stuff to me that kind of rounds out the experience of these are his other adventures, you know, not the limelight, not the showcase material, but you know, hey, they're fun, they're light, they're entertaining. I think it worked well here, like I said, to have In this case, Scrooge and only Gyro. None of the Huey, Dewey, and Louie, no Donald, nothing else to kind of get in the way. I don't think these storytellers would have benefited from additional characters in here. You know, it was a fun story. The next one I found kind of interesting, because the Isle of Ill Will. And it's a fun story of people trying to con Uncle Scrooge. Now, I think if this was done either more recently or more accurately, like you said, I think by a Don Rosa or a Carl Barks, Scrooge would have outplayed the con artists.
Yeah, that's the thing. Scrooge would not have gotten conned unless it was a lot more elaborate con than what was, you know, communicated in this one. This, you know, falling for what he fell for here, you know, he would have never been the richest duck in the world if he, like, fell for this kind of stuff.
Yeah. This was one where he was taken. He was able to recover from it, but this story, like we're saying, if they had done it with the true and full Uncle Scrooge, would have played out very differently, and much more in his favor.
I mean, he would have you could have started out this story the same way, only Scrooge would have noticed, you know, as he was finding the treasure chest and the emerald, he would have been noticing certain things, and then instead of, you know, starting at, you know, where he's transferring the money, he would have done something because he knew he was being conned to turn the tables on these guys. And that's how the story would have wrapped. I mean, you could have started with the same beginning to the story, but then flipped the ending so that Scrooge wasn't such a patsy.
Yeah, instead of, gee, something's not right, it would have been a wait till they discover what I just pulled on them kind of a thing.
Right.
That's the level of depth that these stories just don't have. But, again, I found this entertaining nonetheless. The convention blues, where he's apparently just bought a hotel in time for it to have a convention of crooks. Again, not the classic Uncle Scrooge that we know, but this one's at least slightly more clever than the one we saw in the Isle of Ill Will. He's trying to make the hotel so uninviting to these particular guests that they'll just leave. So it was a step in the right direction. But again, I think certainly a Don Rosa Uncle Scrooge, this would have played out very differently.
Right.
It's also clear in the backgrounds of some of these panels, which is to say there are no backgrounds in some of these panels, that it doesn't have that attention to detail. But again, for, you know, what I'm going to assume it set out to be, which was not a definitive Uncle Scrooge story, but some good Uncle Scrooge stories, these were good. I enjoyed them.
Yeah. It was fine. I mean, I gave it a 3. You know, that's about the level that it's at. It's an average comic and entertaining for what it is, but it's just not transcendent, you know.
And that's the best way to say it. This is, at best, it's average Uncle Scrooge stuff. I think for comics, it's just average in general, so I'd go with that 3. Whereas when we did The Life and Times, that was just some brilliant material, you know. So, the fact that this character in this issue lacked that depth that I so enjoyed in the other stuff certainly didn't help it. Ironically, that was one of the things that I think worked so well in that Justice League issue we talked about. Of all of these characters, we really got to feel and know the personality of Green Arrow, of Firestorm, of the Atom, of the Flash, of all these other characters. It was, to me, that was transcendent in terms of just the material.
Yes. Absolutely. So there we have it. We've done 200 weeks of Weekly Comic Spotlight, and we're capping that off with this special 200 comic book, 200 issue 200s, as I fumble around, issue 200s episode to kind of go along with it. And that's kind of a fun idea. I'm glad you had that idea, and it was fun to read the different comics. And hopefully we'll still be here when we can do the 300.
Yeah, well, that's let's see, another 100 issues is another 300 comics we'll have to review for the Weekly Comic Spotlight. We've reviewed easily 600-700 comics over the course of all the Weekly Comic Spotlight, the back issue spotlights and stuff, and I hope we've helped some people find some stuff they would enjoy. You know, I certainly hope people who are curious about the 80s era of the Justice League and the DC Universe check out that issue because I really do think they'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
So, anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
That'll do it for me.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.